Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Amy Eddings sitting in for Brian Lehrer. It seems we only really think about infrastructure when a levee fails, a bridge collapses, or when New York City goes dark in a blackout. It's not a sexy issue, but according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, it's a necessary one. Our infrastructure is in dire need of repair. And in order to have a modern infrastructure with broadband for all, clean drinking water, a digital power grid, sound bridges and tunnels, experts and elected officials on both sides of the aisle seem to agree that we're going to have to spend lots of money. But in a financial crisis, can we really expect the kind of investment we need? 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 14 is all about infrastructure and technology. Joining us first to lay out our current infrastructure picture and why we should care is David Mongan, president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, and good morning, Amy.
Good morning. What are the most important infrastructure? Infrastructure is such a broad, it encompasses so many things. What do you think are the most important infrastructure issues facing the United States right now?
The infrastructure, as you say, is very broad, and there are very many elements, but it needs to be viewed not in piecemeal, but as a system, because one failure in one element may cascade, and usually does, into another system. So obviously for most Americans, the collapse of that I-35 bridge was a wake-up call about the condition of America's infrastructure. While we're not certain whether the condition was the primary factor, we do know that that bridge was rated structurally deficient for more than 20 years.
Wow.
And at the time of the collapse, 140,000 motorists used that bridge. Those 140,000 motorists, as well as countless businesses, had their lives affected and completely changed for the past year while the new bridge was in place. And fortunately, failures such as this are very rare. But in fact, more than one in four of every bridge in the United States is rated structurally deficient.
I think we have one right here in New York City. The Brooklyn Bridge has some issues.
Yes.
The ASC reports it would take a $1.6 trillion investment to repair all the infrastructure issues facing us now. How did we get into this situation where we need that kind of, is that dollar figure indicative of the high cost of construction and the high cost of materials, or is that indicative of how we have not paid any attention to bridges, tunnels, levees for decades?
Let me explain that number was developed in 2005 when we issued our most recent report card. The $1.6 trillion that you refer to is an investment that we should make over 5 years. It's not a per year, it's a total. And currently, about half of that money is being spent collectively by federal, state, and local government agencies. This was a number to bring our nation's infrastructure from our grade of D up to an acceptable C, B minus grade. It wasn't to expand our infrastructure, but simply to provide the maintenance funds that we need. We didn't get into this situation overnight, and we're not going to get out of it overnight. Our bridges, many of them are well over 40 years. The average age of a dam in this country is 49 years. There are 80,000 dams in this country. 12,000 are rated as high hazard. By that I mean if it were to fail, a potential loss of life would ensue. We've failed to keep up with the maintenance and the repair and the upkeep of many elements of our infrastructure. Drinking water. The major metropolitan areas, particularly in the East Coast, the water and sewer facilities, the pipes that are buried that we take for granted every day, many of them are 100 years or more in age.
Well, certainly here we experience that in New York all the time with these huge cast iron water mains cracking and failing, and you find out they're 80-plus years old. You say for decades we've ignored maintaining our infrastructure. Why is that? What's sucked up our dollars instead and our attention instead?
Well, building new facilities is always politically and to some extent socially more attractive. To go out and cut the ribbon on a new highway and to provide that new service to the motorist, you know, is important, and we need to do that. But at the same time, we spent that kind of money and failed to maintain what we had. You know, economic choices are made every day, and I think we've made some poor choices. Plus, what's exacerbated the problem is our growth in population and our shift in population. More people are living in urbanized areas, and we've seen significant growth in many regions. For instance, in the Las Vegas area, it has exploded in population and created significant demands on water supply and wastewater. They're instituting a number of actions that are going to address conservation and reuse of their water. Just last summer, we had major concerns about water supply in Atlanta. And again, that's right. The direct result of the burgeoning growth that we've seen in these cities.
David Mongan is president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, laying out the issue that we are exploring today, Issue 14, infrastructure. Thank you so much, David Mongan, for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, we will talk with the representatives from both campaigns, Barack Obama's and John McCain's, on what their candidates will do about our aging infrastructure. Stay tuned. Good morning, I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. Infrastructure hasn't been high on the priority list for either candidate, especially now that the economy has eclipsed a lot of the issues. So what can we expect from the next administration? We have representatives from each of the campaigns with us this morning. First, we have Stephen Flynn, a senior fellow in national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and an unpaid senior advisor to Barack Obama. Later, we will have senior policy advisor to the McCain campaign, Douglas Holtz Aiken. Stephen Flynn, welcome to WNYC.
It's very good to be with you.
Let's start with a clip of Senator Obama during the first presidential debate in response to a question about what he would be willing to cut in light of our current financial crisis. He lays out here what he says he would not cut.
I also think that we're going to have to rebuild our infrastructure, which is falling behind. Our roads, our bridges, but also broadband lines that reach into rural communities. Also making sure that we have a new electricity grid to get the alternative energy to population centers that are using them.
Broadband for all. Who wouldn't want that? But how will he pay for it?
Well, I think what's so important, first of all, is that it seems we've got lost over the last two decades thinking about infrastructure as something that's a cost that we can't afford. It has always been viewed by every generation of Americans as an investment. It's what makes our society competitive. It improves our quality of life. It makes us more safer. The idea that we can afford not to have good infrastructure, that we can have brittle infrastructure as the most prosperous society in the world, is just a fool's game. Broken or brittle infrastructure is bad for our economy, bad for our safety, and certainly bad for the quality of our life. So it's an investment that we simply have to make. And clearly, when we're in an information age, the idea that large portions of our population, you know, are still doing dial-ups for internet connections, I mean, doesn't work. So this is the kind of investment we need to make. And as we're clearly seeing with the current economic downturn and the crisis that we're in, you don't get out of these crises by stopping spending and essentially closing up, as the Fed is certainly doing by trying to push a lot of money into the system to get credit going again. We also need to get people working again. And when you invest in infrastructure, you're investing in real jobs that you can't outsource. They're American jobs. And the basic estimates are, for instance, in the area of highways, for every dollar you spend on a highway, you get $6 back into the economy in terms of domestic demand. And in addition to that, for every $1 billion you spend on highways, you generate 42,000 jobs. So this is real economic stimulus with real advantages for our society, and that we get, again, a better working society that makes it more competitive and ultimately a higher quality of life and a safer place to live.
Reinvesting and rebuilding the nation's infrastructure seems to be the centerpiece of an economic stimulus package and a job stimulus package that Barack Obama has come up with. Tell me about the National Reinvestment Bank and what it is and how it works.
Well, this is a proposal originally made by Senators Chris Dodd and Chuck Hagel. It's a bipartisan proposal. And what it basically does is puts together, makes available up to $60 billion for state and local governments to propose ideas about what infrastructure needs to be, what investments we need to make. The notion of having essentially this investment bank evaluate the proposals and provide the initial funding is really one that basically brings some better quality control to what I think is one of the main reasons why Americans have been largely unsupportive of investments in infrastructure, is the sense that it's all pork, and that basically it's, you know, congressional chairman in the right place at the right time, we get bridges to nowhere. So this has been one part is to actually get real money out there, but also manage it in a way that the projects essentially have to pass a smile test that actually improve infrastructure, have real positive things, whether it's improving our environment, improving the economic productivity. And then money is made available, and basically the $60 billion can translate into close to $300 billion, because with the backing of of this money, you can raise additional credit, and we can put a lot of money into our economy at a relatively at a smaller cost for taxpayers. And then again, we get the better results of a more productive economy that brings revenues back into the whole process.
So Obama would allocate $60 billion to this National Reinvestment Bank, and you think it will leverage $300 billion, because $600 billion sounds like a drop in the bucket. We're hearing from our previous guest, David Mongan, from the American Society of Civil Engineers, something like $1.6 trillion is needed. But you think that this $600 billion will spur more money pouring into this National Reinvestment Bank?
Yeah, the basic process is it's $60 billion, but it is leveraging those dollars so that you can raise additional capital that states and locals would need. But with the backing of the government, makes the loans cheaper, more affordable. Certainly, I think we're going to have to be looking as a nation at a lot more money than even this effort, and sooner versus later. This is one of the conversations that obviously is going to happen when the new next president steps into the Oval Office, looks at the state of the economy. What's very clear, and what certainly Senator Obama has recognized, is that, again, investment in infrastructure is just that. It's investment. It's not a cost we can't afford. You know, to a large extent, we've been behaving a bit like a generation's inherited our grandparents' mansion. We decide not to do any upkeep. And everybody's driving by, think it's a nice house, but the wiring's gone to heck. The plumbing doesn't work. It simply doesn't make sense. Let everything fall apart, and that's what we've been at here for too long, as the American Society of Civil Engineers is so well documented. And this is a national alarm that should be sound, and something that the next president clearly has to confront.
Stephen Flynn is a senior fellow in national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and an unpaid senior advisor to Senator Barack Obama. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. So is this like a WPA program for the 21st century? How does Barack Obama see jobs being created out of this? I just see a lot of union jobs, but there are barriers to becoming a union worker, no?
Yeah, there are. I think the better analogy is actually the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System, which came to us, of course, by a Republican who looked at the state of our infrastructure and saw it as both a national security issue. In fact, the Interstate Highway System was created by an act in 1956 called the Interstate Highway and Defense Act. And it was that if the Cold War got hot, you needed to be able to mobilize a nation quickly or evacuate cities. And that was one of the rationales, that there was essentially a larger national imperative to make this investment that transcended just the flow of economic activity. But happily, of course, it served primarily the economic stimulus and a productivity stimulus that came with that investment. It's basically a recognition that we have, as a country, largely neglected our infrastructure for too long. We have to make prudent investments for all the reasons we just laid out earlier.
Right, but how does this create jobs?
Well, it creates, obviously, it's well-paying jobs and good jobs when you're building things. And we have a construction industry that's obviously in idle right now because of the collapse of the housing sector. So we have a lot of skills out there that we can certainly bring to bear. There's little question that there are some trades where we have a manpower shortage, and this is going to create a real need for making sure we have the folks with the kinds of skills that we had that built this stuff in the first place.
Would some of this money go toward people being trained in these kind of skills and being, shoehorning people into these unions?
Yeah, I mean, clearly, again, this is a lot that has to be fleshed out, and when the next president steps into office, he's going to have to look at this much more broadly, and I think the economic crisis we're in mandates that that has to happen sooner versus later, and with a great deal of this kind of conversation. Do we have the skill sets? How do we make those kinds of prudent investment in the education that we'll need and the training we'll need? We simply can't keep going on as a society. Expect to be competitive, obviously, by allowing the foundations of any modern society erode, and that's been going on for too long, and that's where just cutting taxes alone won't solve the problem. We need revenues, and revenues are they have to be invested in the kinds of things that will make us more productive and make our economy work better, so those new revenues can come in and both feed the other services we need as well as ultimately balance out for taxpayers in the end.
So let's hit on one last infrastructure issue here, something close to the vice presidential candidate's heart. Transportation. Joe Biden, Barack Obama have talked about investing in rail transit. This is always an area that gets neglected. Money's approved and then not allocated. Tell me how this will change under an Obama and Amtrak riding Biden administration.
Well, I think it will get more emphasis than clearly it has been. Again, we've been having a hard time even coughing the dollars up to maintain this critical infrastructure.
But funding Amtrak has not been a very popular conversation on the Hill. How would President Obama move that conversation along?
Well, I think it hasn't been. It's one that's been allowed to sort of fester without the presidential level of engagement, and I don't think it can be advanced without a broader discussion with the American people about the need for this kind of investment. And the investment that we make in this mass transit that allows us to get less dependent on the kind of fossil fuels that are being used, obviously in cars and so forth, and deal with the fact that we have so many people in our urban areas. I mean, the bottom line is we have to raise the profile of this conversation, the years of neglect that we can't afford to pay for things that are critical to the foundation of modern society. I think Senator Obama has made pretty clear that would stop on his watch, and we would begin a necessary conversation, a long overdue one, for what we need to get done and how we'll go about paying for it. It's dollars are going to be certainly in high debate, but again, the bottom line here is Senator Obama recognized, and I certainly endorse this idea that we're really talking about making investments in our future and our prosperity, not costs that we can't afford.
Stephen Flynn is a senior fellow in national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and an unpaid senior advisor to Barack Obama. Thanks so much for joining us on this 30 Issues in 30 Days segment on infrastructure.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joining us now from the McCain campaign is senior policy advisor Douglas Holtz Aiken. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
Neither candidate has made infrastructure investment a prominent part of their platform. On This Week with George Stephanopoulos a couple weeks ago, even Robert Reich of the American Prospect and Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, agreed that investing in infrastructure should be a priority. But we haven't heard very much about specific plans to deal with our crumbling infrastructure. Tell me specifically what a McCain-Palin administration would do to deal with this problem.
Well, I think there are two major features that are important and reflective of the fact that, you know, John McCain has been involved in every piece of transportation legislation for the past 20 years. And one is to focus on the real problem, and that is we have points of congestion, major urban areas, the Denvers, the Northern Virginias, the New York cities, Las Vegas, Nevada, where the congestion is taking a great toll on both the travel times of individuals and also the key economies of those areas, where we're having freight caught up in that traffic. And the second piece of congestion is in the port to rail and road networks, where our booming world economy, which was the sort of for the past 5 years one of the significant features, now troubled, quite frankly, but we saw that we couldn't handle the freight capacity in and out, and that was harming our ability to compete internationally. So those are points where the focus will have to be to use federal, state, and local stakeholders at the table to find out the best strategies on those congestion.
So to work, to come up with the strategy by working with local officials. So yeah, strategy at this time, but definitely a recognition that something needs to be done.
I hope there's a bipartisan recognition there's something needs to be done. I mean, there may be differences in how we get there, but I think that these are sort of economic facts that are open and plain to see. You know, Senator McCain has been long concerned about the process by which transportation dollars are allocated. I don't think you have to be a sophisticated follower of things to know that there were, you know, so many earmarks in the last $286 billion bill, you know, about 6,000, and that interferes with choosing projects on the basis of their economic priorities and instead uses political priorities. That's not a route to economic success. And
does he have a plan to change that process?
Well, he tried. I mean, one of the important pieces of infrastructure legislation is the Water Resources Development Act. And he introduced a bipartisan bill, so Thrust Feingold a while back, to take that bill, which is about $26 billion, if memory serves me correctly, and is entirely earmarked at this point in time, to take that bill and have the projects evaluated and rated by an independent set of outside experts so that the Corps of Engineers would be pursuing those projects on the basis of their merit, not on the basis of the earmarks. That bill got defeated. You know, the senators had a long crusade against earmarks, both for what they've done to the Congress and their corrupting influence, but also because the American taxpayer is sinking substantial monies into addressing the problem, but the money's not showing up in the real problem. And so that process issue has to be addressed, or we'll simply build more of the bridges to nowhere kind of thing that won't solve our pressing economic needs in this area.
While we're talking about money, here's a clip of John McCain from the first presidential debate talking about our power infrastructure. Let's listen.
We can create 700,000 jobs by constructing 45 new nuclear power plants by the year 2030. Nuclear power is not only important as far as eliminating our dependence on foreign oil, but it's also important as far as climate change is concerned.
So 45 nuclear power plants by 2030, that sounds like it requires a lot of money to make that happen. Would a McCain administration help finance that?
This is an aggressive goal. Right now, nuclear power provides about 20% of the electricity generated to our grid. Merely keeping it at 20% would require building 30 or so new generation facilities, nuclear generation facilities. 45 would move that dial a bit north, but not dramatically north in any way. Still, given the permitting times that are taking nearly a decade, you'd have to shorten that. You would have to address the ability to store or reprocess spent fuel. There have been tremendous political obstacles to that, and that's something he clearly recognizes and is willing to take on.
But again, and Douglas, then, where does would the money for this kind of infrastructure improvement, looking at building more nuclear power plants, would that come from tax cuts, or would that come from an infusion of capital or grants from the federal government, or a mixture of both under a McCain administration?
Nuclear power facilities should be built by the private sector. I mean, there is on the books now a program to subsidize the first five or so of these new generation facilities that came through the 2000 five Energy Act or seven Energy Act, I forget which. There's no need to continue that. John McCain would put in place a cap-and-trade system to address global warming, that's an instant business model for a technology that has zero carbon emissions, is a very low marginal cost of production of electricity. And so, you know, the private sector should go build these. There's a business model for them to build them. There's a public benefit to having the air be cleaner and the globe safer. It doesn't require the federal government to spend all the money on this.
Senator McCain voted against the Transportation Equity Act in 2005, which was almost $300 billion for highways, public transit, and other public works. He advocated for making Amtrak free of the need for congressional funding and has voted against allocated money to rail. Explain this record and tell me if this signals that he would advocate for further privatization of transportation as president.
Well, the record's simple. I mean, he would like to see real effective transportation funding and real effective reforms in Amtrak, and he's not willing to sign the bill that had, over 6,000 earmarks as part of the nearly $300 billion of spending. Why not have the spending done on the basis of merit as he tried in that other legislation? And on Amtrak, you know, in 1971, it was set up to be self-sustaining within 2 years. And what we've seen is a now over three decades long track record of simply getting more money from the American taxpayer without undertaking the reforms in the Northeast Corridor that could put it on a more self-sustaining basis.
But no,
that's all he wants.
But no public transportation, no subway or bus, no public transportation system is self-sustaining. It all needs state and city dollars to help run. It's not run on revenue alone.
But that's not an excuse to fail to undertake the reforms that would have it undertake adequate maintenance so that the Acela doesn't simply stop running at points when it's needed in inner city transportation, and where there are surprise requests to Congress to match the shortfalls in the Amtrak system. I mean, it needs to be run on a sound basis. If it's going to be subsidized by the federal government, the taxpayers are especially owed a responsible management and a transparent accounting so that these kinds of things don't happen.
You now famously attributed the creation of the BlackBerry to the work Senator McCain did on the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation.
And I have now famously sworn off jokes for the remainder
right.
of the campaign.
So it was a joke. You didn't you didn't mean to imply that he he was key in making the BlackBerry come about?
I meant only to try to add some levity to a press briefing, and I will cease doing that forever.
Don't ever laugh again. You broke it. But seriously, tell me the role that he has played in the development of technology policy.
I mean, he was chairman of the Commerce Committee for an important period in the evolution of what we've seen in telecommunications, modern information technologies, and has quite frankly both been on the side of improved regulation, where particularly with data security, the do not call features, where consumer protections are important, he was aggressive. But he, for example, opposed the 96 Telecommunications Act, which came through his jurisdiction because he felt it was too much of a giveaway to the incumbent Bell operating companies and didn't have enough competition. And I think history's shown him to be right on both sides of those issues. So that was an important period, and those are important areas. We know how important modern information technologies are to all aspects of American life and the vitality of our businesses and commercial sector especially. That's been, a real proud accomplishment and great learning experience.
We're going to be talking about Wi-Fi and broadband and the Internet in our next segment. Talk about John McCain's plan on bringing broadband Internet access across the country. What kind of federal tax breaks or federal investment is he prepared to advocate for?
Well, the People Connect program is the particular issue he's concerned about, which is really a rural broadband issue. In high-density areas, there's a business model for broadband and vigorous competition between cable and wireless and satellite and all the options is the best way to go.
So vigorous that it's not happening. I mean, in New York City, it's just been enormously difficult to wire up New York City.
And in those circumstances, he has taken the step to be the one who said, look, if municipalities want to step in, because the private sector has failed, they should be permitted to do so. There was a Pennsylvania case in particular where Philadelphia wanted to provide wireless broadband to its residents, and the private companies tried to block that. There's no reason why the private sector can't face competition from all sources, and he's happy with that. The place he really sees the issue is getting it into sparsely populated areas. Obviously, his history in Arizona makes him particularly sensitive to this, and there he favors, you know, tax credits for those companies that are actually getting the broadband out to rural consumers, so they are not left behind in this particular area.
And you think it'll be easier to wire up rural areas than it has been for wiring up New York City?
Wiring may not be the way to go. And in fact, probably the biggest mistake would be to place a bet as a matter of policy on any single delivery of broadband. The goal is to get broadband. It may be a WiMAX technology. It may be a satellite technology. We don't know. That's been one of the lessons of the evolution in this area.
Douglas Holtz Aiken is a senior policy advisor for Senator John McCain. Thank you for joining us again here on WNYC.
My pleasure.
Amy Eddings sitting in for WNYC's Brian Lehrer. We just heard from representatives of Senator Barack Obama and Senator John McCain about how their administrations would deal with the crumbling infrastructure of the United States and also how to expand that infrastructure, certainly in the way of internet technology. Less than 10 years ago, the idea of checking the news headlines or looking for that perfect cupcake recipe wirelessly on your computer seemed like a fantasy. And affordable wireless internet? Forget about it. Speed up to the present day, and cities like St. Louis and Chicago are in the planning stages of implementing wireless internet programs, and some, like Baltimore, are already there. So is Wi-Fi for a city affordable? And if so, why isn't it here in New York City already? For more on this, we've got Andrew Roche. He's the founder of Personal Democracy Forum. He served as chairman of the Howard Dean Technology Advisory Council for the 2004 presidential race. He also ran for public advocate of New York City in 2005, running in the Democratic primary on a platform to bring low-cost wireless access to all New Yorkers. He's not here to endorse one candidate or another. He's here to talk about why it's so difficult for cities to become wireless. Andrew Roche, welcome to WNYC.
Pleasure to be here.
Why has wireless internet access become such an important national issue?
Well, the United States still remains 18th or 19th in the world in broadband penetration, and it's become very clear to even those who come from the 20th century industrial economy that for the United States to be competitive with the rest of the world, we have to create a 21st century infrastructure. So it's very important for the future of our country, not only for economic development, job creation, but the efficiencies that we're going to need to be able to drive the cost of getting things done down when more and more things are connected to each other and there's more information available to people so that better decisions can be made about where to spend money.
Can it still be a big priority given this current financial crisis and all the money we're spending to help help prop up the financial industry?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the key things to remember here is that how we got here is that we actually have a duopoly of telecom and cable industry companies. I think there's only 11 major ones in the United States now who have been giving massive amounts of money to the political system on both sides of the aisle in order to maintain their ability to control the market and to limit the ability of competitors to bring the price down. We already actually have a huge amount of wireless infrastructure in New York. Many people who have broadband in their apartments have Wi-Fi transmitters that sometimes are locked down and sometimes are open, but technically under terms of service with either Verizon or with Time Warner, it is illegal for you, in effect, expect to share your Wi-Fi connection with anyone other than those in your immediate household. And
Why would I want to share it if I'm the one paying for it?
Well, you may want to share it if, for example, and I'm not trying to endorse this company, but there's a company called Phone that was started out in Madrid in Spain that allows people to share their Wi-Fi. And in exchange, wherever they travel in the world, if they come across another a member of the community that's sharing in the same way, they can get on their network. So it's sort of like portable Wi-Fi. It's a Wi-Fi sharing community. If you give, you get. And it's a very innovative way of expanding the ability of more and more people to get online. And by the way, if you're not a member of the community and you run into a signal from that, from one of those transmitters, wherever you may be in the world, it's $2 or $3 a day, I think, to get online, and it runs with you for 24 hours. So it brings the cost down because the infrastructure is already there, and it allows for to basically answer your first question, which is that there are innovative ways to get to solve the problem of how to get more people online. If we just look at how the whole system has been set up in the first place.
And we're taking your calls on this, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Your calls for Andrew Roche. Perhaps you've got some great idea on how to bring Wi-Fi to all of New York City. What questions do you have about Internet access? Do you think that there should be a great push by the next administration to expand Internet access throughout the United States? Do you think it should just be incentives to the private sector to naturally bring this expansion of Wi-Fi up from the grassroots, so to speak? 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Baltimore recently became a Wi-Fi city. There's a lot of economic disparity there. The cost per home for this Wi-Fi access is about $50. Is that considered affordable in Baltimore?
Well, it's $50 for a working class family a month over the course is $600 a year. So that's probably not very affordable, but it's a step in the right direction. And as we see this unfold, we're going to see that people are going to be able to use more than just computers to get online. The phones that we have, the iPhones and the BlackBerries and other devices, and there's new ones every few months, keep improving the network so that we may stop thinking about it as computer-centric connectivity to the world and to the information that it can provide and to the benefits of access to that information. We may start seeing more of this migrate to a mobile environment where the issues of having a computer in the home and having a broadband connection from a major cable operator or telco operator for $50 or $60 a month isn't going to be necessary.
You, when addressing the question of why larger cities like New York and L.A. are not Wi-Fi cities yet, you seem to suggest that part of it is the competition between companies trying to wire up and provide these services. From a public policy standpoint, is there anything that you would want to see either an Obama administration or a McCain administration do to either bring those barriers down or stop the kind of battles that seem to clog up process?
Well, I mean, there's a number of different things you're bringing up. I mean, first of all, the infrastructure of New York with a lot of tall buildings, a lot of steel, a lot of concrete doesn't make it real easy to just all of a sudden put Wi-Fi transmitters on telephone poles and make it easy for everybody to get online. That said, the city of New York is spending $400 million on a wireless network that is going to be available only for city employees. And it won't, in effect, be Wi-Fi. It will be a slightly different technology. But the city is spending money on a wireless infrastructure. But the thing that's unfortunate about that particular plan is that it doesn't trust the public. There's no reason why that network shouldn't be available and open to the public. And then in an emergency shutdown, or if it needed to be controlled directly by the police or the fire department, then the public wouldn't be allowed on it. So the infrastructure, the money for it is actually being spent. What doesn't exist in New York is really a vision about the way in which a society in the 21st century can participate in its civic life by actually being connected to each other, people taking pictures of potholes and sending them into the city, people noticing things, people, you know, our subways and buses in New York, for example, don't even tell us when they're going to arrive. You know,
there's a program that was underway to make that happen, but it's been delayed.
It's been delayed, and, you know, there are technologies that are out there that are in the public realm, not in the, don't require a huge amount of money, that are starting to show ways in which people collaborating together can get things done, to the benefit of everyone in the community. But back to your original question, there are some very important things that the next president could do, one of which is to declare broadband to be something more than 200 kbps, which is, you know, incredibly low and much lower than what's available in South Korea and Japan and many countries of Europe.
Kbps, kilobytes per second?
Correct. And we still have a very sort of low threshold for what we describe as broadband. Secondly, that we need to have an updating of the Universal Service Act in 1934, in order to make sure that Ma Bell, which had a monopoly then, didn't maintain its monopoly unfairly. The government forced Ma Bell to wire rural areas because it would cost a huge amount of money to run a dial tone to a farm out on the prairie. But in order to maintain a monopoly, they did pass the Universal Service Act, and every home in America was guaranteed the right to have dial tone. We need to relook at that in the context of the 21st century, and the fact that we in fact still do have a monopoly now, and think about guaranteeing everyone access to the internet if they want it at a reasonable cost.
Andrew, I want to take a call. David from Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I wanted to make 2 points, and that is, it really saddens me that we are looking to the government to do everything for us. I mean, it's like, I mean, the government, the federal government is $10 trillion in debt. I don't think McCain or Obama should be dealing with this issue at all. As far as this issue, people have got to start prioritizing. If they feel that Wi-Fi is something that they need, then they should pay for it. I don't feel that the government and the universal service idea just means more taxes on your phone bill. Look at all the taxes right now on your phone bill. People are being taxed right out of this area of the country.
David from Jersey City, thank you so much. We're going to another call. Jim from Delaware County, you're on WNYC. Good morning. What's your story?
Good morning. I'm sorry for the telephone, but I'm in New Jersey on my way from New York back to my home in Delaware County, upstate, 3 hours. And we run a business up there, and we have a satellite HughesNet, which is better than dial-up, but it's still frustratingly slow sometimes. And the local schools have T1 lines, and the lines run down the main roads off of where we live on a sort of secondary road. But my question is, what's the best possible solution for a person or a place like where the satellite seems to be the only alternative right now, and the Verizon or cable Time Warner doesn't want to spend the money to run the stuff out there. So, and just lastly, I've heard of a technology. I thought Google was working on something that would deliver internet through the grid that you could plug into an outlet in your wall and somehow receive internet signal. So,
thank you so much. Thanks, Jim, for that call. Andrew, I'm going to massage this a little bit. I don't want to get bogged down in too many details about addressing his particular problem. You can, but I'd also like to know if that problem is a problem that a lot of Americans are experiencing, and is this something that a presidential candidate should take on?
Well, I think I can answer questions for both callers, because I'm not advocating that the government spend money. I'm advocating that there be leadership at the top that changes the way we regulate our cable and telephone industry so that there is more opportunities for small businesses like David's in upstate New York to be able to get online, because Verizon and Time Warner or whoever is serving his cable industry serving him in that area doesn't want to spend the money to put in the infrastructure to be able to service him, and therefore his ability to compete in the 21st century is limited. Going further, though, You know, it's probably going to be a while before we see utility companies allowing people to plug in, you know, their computers into their phones, I mean, into their walls in order to, you know, get the internet through power lines. That's technology that's been discussed and it's been deployed in some places, but it's still not universal and it's probably not coming anytime soon. So my suggestion for him is actually to probably get to try to connect to his network to as many cell phone transmitters that can be plugged into their computers and use the cell networks to try to get online, because it's probably going to be faster than the satellite service that he has now.
And we have to leave it there. Thank you, Andrew Roche, founder of Personal Democracy Forum, former chairman of the Howard Dean Technology Advisory Council for the 2004 presidential race.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll talk about the city of the future as our 30 Issues in 30 Days segment on infrastructure continues. Stay with us. Hear that? It's the soundtrack of the city of the future, where we commute to work in rocket ships, all our household appliances float in midair, and everything else in our life falls into place through the miracles of technology and science. But if 30 years ago we thought we'd be living in the age of the Jetsons, by now we know we were sadly mistaken. Currently, the U.S. spends only 2% of its GDP investing in infrastructure like roads and bridges. That's small change compared to other countries. My next guest is Robert Yarrow. He says if we continue along this path, our city of the future will be a mere pipe dream of the past. Robert Yarrow is president of the Regional Plan Association, and he joins me now along with Dayan Sujic. He says he spends way too much time traveling around the world. He's the director of the Design Museum London and the editor of The Endless City from Faden Press. Robert Yarrow and Dayan Sujic, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Amy, how are you?
Fine,
good
thanks.
Morning.
Good morning.
Hey, do they have potholes in the Jetsons? I just don't remember.
I think, you know, he just floated above them. So,
yeah, I think so, yeah.
Maybe airstream holes.
Yeah.
Robert, we mentioned the U.S. spending just 2% of its GDP on infrastructure. How does that compare with other countries?
Well, it's about half of what Europe is investing, and you know, maybe a third of what countries like Spain and are spending. China really leads the world. About 9% of GDP in China goes into infrastructure. Of course, they're playing catch up ball, but you know, they've actually gone way beyond us. I mean, they're beyond catch up. I mean, they're now very far along in a modernized high speed rail system and goods movement systems and so forth that are going to leave us in the dust if we don't start to do likewise.
Dayan, you just came from Moscow. Could you explain how your experience there helped craft an idea of the worst case scenario for U.S. cities like New York City?
Well, I think you'd have to imagine a city in which taxi drivers have vanished from the streets owing to a kind of complex mafia problem. But for the last 5 years, the only way to get a taxi in Moscow is to stand in the street and flag down a passing Lada and haggle about the fare. And once you've got into that taxi, it's going to take you 2.5 hours to reach the airport.
Wow.
Which is obviously something which is not doing great things to the attractiveness of Moscow as a place to work.
And that's because of congestion? Because of poor roads? What?
It's a mixture of things, but it's certainly a reflection of Moscow as the capital of the Wild East, in which fortunes are being made, but not much of that fortune is being invested in the future of the city right now.
Bob, a few months ago you were in China. It seems like folks are pointing to Beijing as the city of the future, but especially with the Olympics, questions were raised about, well, at the expense of who? The use of eminent domain to just clear out large tracts of land, squelching of public protest about eminent domain, about environmental issues. What did you see in Beijing, and is it a model for what we should be doing here?
Well, look, we're not suggesting that we like the idea, the authoritarian government in Beijing and their approach to eminent domain and dealing with the public. You know, I think the fact is that they've built a modern regional rail system. They're building a high-speed intercity rail system to connect Beijing with other cities in China, and they've developed a modern goods movement system, a rail freight system that's integrated with seaports and airports. And you know, those, and we don't need to we don't need to be more like the Chinese in the sense that we need to use authoritarian techniques to build this stuff, but we do need to reach into our pockets, and that's of course what the Chinese are doing. And most U.S. cities just simply have not maintained our existing systems. You know, and that's something we have in common with Moscow. I mean, there are a lot of potholes and busted pavement and that sort of thing in every U.S. city, and certainly in a place like New York. You know, we don't have good airport access. We don't have high-speed rail. You know, the Acela. I mean, the good news: the Congress last week approved funding to upgrade Acela. But the bad news is that it's just not going to be a world-class system, even when that's done.
Bob, you're going to Istanbul tonight. What will you be looking for there?
Well, we've been asked to help them with an infrastructure plan and as part of a larger metropolitan development plan. And it's pretty interesting that Turkey, which is a very modern country, and Istanbul, which is a world city, they are now investing in major infrastructure systems to not just catch up with the rest of Europe, but to surpass a lot of Europe. So most of the world is doing this, and I think one could argue that the chastening effect of the decline in Wall Street and the credit crunch could cause us to focus on these more basic needs for the that we're going to have to build a different kind of economy.
Dejan Cukic, very quickly, what your dream of a dream city is? 15 seconds.
The trouble is that we used to have dreams, and we found that most of those dreams went sour. So we're a generation that doesn't think about what the future of a city could be. It would be great to recover that in a more realistic sense.
Dejan Cukic is the director of the Design Museum in London and the editor of The Endless City from Fade and Press. Robert Yarrow on his way to Istanbul tonight. He's the president of the Regional Plan Association. Thank you for talking about dream cities.
Great, thanks.
Thank you for having us.
The conversation continues online at WNYC.org. Click on The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Amy Eddings, in for Brian Lehrer. He'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.